George Jeffries, 27. George Jeffries woke up in Pine Gap. George Jeffries. I woke up in Pine Gap. My old Langley beer buddy was still discussing the metaphysical necessity of understanding espionage to provide a macrocosm to oppose the microcosm of obvious immediate reality. I think I had suggested the idea before I realised that it sounded like something out of the CIA handbook. He had been monologuing on it for a couple of hours. Claire had slid down to kneel next to my legs with her head on my lap, and I could feel her small teeth absent-mindedly gnawing somewhere near my knee through my trouser leg. She was becoming more relaxedly childlike all the time, and therefore more obviously bored. I wondered again why bored women are always so sexually attractive. I positioned the inside of my thumb against her neck and stroked it back and forth on half an inch of smooth, tight skin. She smiled with the corners of her lips tucked down in mischief. My buddy concluded, "You know, George, I think that idea of yours explains why I've stuck so long with the company. Any other reality seems so shallow, as if there isn't any gold." The door opened, and in one of those spectral shifts that happen in a desert, the brilliant night sky suddenly seemed to have possessed all the room. Olivia entered with Corbin in her arms. As often with toddlers, he had swaggered out unsteadily, tugging her hand for a walk, but then fallen asleep shortly after, so that she had to carry him home. She puffed. "We were halfway to Alice Springs. Jesus, he's heavy." Corbin was not solidly built. He had Claire's build, not mine. But Olivia was looking jet-lagged and frail. Claire uncoiled gracefully and received him back into her arms. Olivia went to my drinking buddy and finished his beer with a touching macho flamboyance. He seemed suitably flattered and interested. It was anyway intriguing for him that Olivia was an indigenous ASIO agent from Mount Druitt, who had enlisted after seeing recruitment posters when completing her professional writing degree at the University of Western Sydney. Even before that, she had written pieces against Indigenous deaths in custody for the Murdoch Press, actually one of their long-term pet subjects, and was comfortable with them since even earlier they had helped rescue one of her imprisoned aunties. She was close to Claire and me because another of her aunties was our old friend Ruth, who still ran a labyrinthine Western Suburbs women's shelter system. But Olivia's relationship with Claire was intense and edgy, and each tried to tease professional information from the other. Stylized banter, but more practical than a game. Claire told me she found Olivia sexy, but some of Claire's so confiding in me was just obligatory verbal foreplay that lightens the tone between uneasy lovers. After over 40 years of practiced physical and psychological expertise in each other, Claire and I were still uneasy lovers. She saw that I was watching her seriously and handed me the still-sleeping Corbin. I said, "Sometimes I think people hand each other babies the way dolphins splash water at each other, as an extension of their ability to touch." Olivia said, "Yeah, when I was young, I was taught that dolphins are very good at compensating for their being stuck in the water all the time." "I'm not stuck in any water," said Claire, "and I touch people directly when I want to." But she shut the screen door, as if her childhood of murderous touches still tossed outside there in the dark. I poured more Victoria Bitter, and my buddy smelt it, his upper lip pressing the glass with a casual, weary gesture. I asked him, "How are they reacting in Langley to the new book about MKUltra? There was a current one, Poisoner-in-Chief, about the appalling Gottlieb who had run MKUltra, Artichoke, and then run more things like them. And of course there was also a journalist's book documenting unsurprisingly, that the Manson gang had been programmed by Gottlieb's people." Of course it's all true, George, but you know the old method. Admit to the most bizarre bits and no one looks at the rest of it, or at what is still happening as we speak. Right now, the ultra stock is most used on the head choppers in Syria to keep them uptight about Assad, but you've seen that. Mainly in Langley, the heads are still hissing at each other about Russia and China, and they're obsessed trying to get their different global green capitalist things going about climate change. The word global refastened his attention on Olivia. Claire said, "He's here, Liv, not just to replace George's phone and sync it to the new satellites, but to make you an informal offer. Someone at Constitution Avenue, Campbell ACT, the ASIO headquarters, must be okay about it, or they wouldn't have flown you here." I said, "That probably just means they're okay about you considering it." Olivia agreed. "They give me a lot of leeway." Claire scoffed. "00, license to kill." Adding, "And I appreciate them doing that, so what's the offer?" He drank all his VB. "Langley are organising an international Indigenous Peoples Conference. Lots of stuff on climate change, strength in global numbers, etc. Our NGOs will agenda it. More democratic decisions will become international, not local. Stress on the similarities in Indigenous emergencies. Lots of business class travel and not by energy neutral yachts." Claire, "Lots of Afghan heroin money going to this lots more seductive cause." He added, "How would you feel about being a delegate, maybe being the chairperson, Olivia?" I was grateful that Claire's and my NGO was one of the few remaining that Langley didn't consider to belong to them or to MI6. It was still true, as it had been traditionally, that MI6 tended to run Langley. Claire whispered to Olivia, "You just have to explain to Ruth why her new shelter committee will be in Geneva." But Olivia's forehead furrowed with contemplation. Corbyn woke and he and I continued to discover the exciting improved buttons on my free new cell phone. Claire's head pressed harshly into my knee again as if she suffered from migraine. Corbyn was on a sling on George's chest. George and Claire held hands as the dawn swam more plainly into view around the ghost sickle moon of the equinox. They are outside the low little rooms at Pine Gap. While young Olivia and George's old Langley drinking companion meandered in indistinct discussion further out toward hill rocks that were violet on the horizon. Stars were still there for a short time. Claire said, "It's strange to think that this sky gave the information to the round white mushrooms behind us about where to position so many drone strikes for Obama and later. Whenever you talk to the staff there, they seem uninvolved in planning death." He said, "They aren't like you. They still think that they can compartmentalize their past." She thought about it. "Yes, they do that, but the mind has many mansions, many rooms, and the children I killed as a child are in my brain, with me in reality physically and cognitively, to enjoy the moon's wane even when I'm not aware existentially of them. I remain always their agent. My mind is a constant act of espionage." A native tree purpling out of rocky blackness reminded George then of something he had seen. He realized it was a Moscow statue of Richard Sorge stepping out from his shape in the wall behind him, his face Germanic with deadly resolution, his hands in his trench coat pockets casual with momentum, to die for spying for Russia against the Axis. Claire followed George's gaze and saw the image. She said, "Yes, Sorge is leaving his edifice. This does seem a good place for it." Olivia strolled back to them with George's Langley friend. Claire asked, "Have you decided?" Olivia's hands fisted her trench coat pockets. She said, "Yes, I'm leaving with him on the plane."